Hi, this is Warren Olney. Thanks so much for listening to this podcast of To the Point, and I want to tell you about another podcast that's available here at KCRW, and that's the program DNA, hosted by Frances Anderton. Frances is well connected in the industry of design and architecture and art. She used to be editor of an architecture magazine. She knows the trends before they happen. She'll be able to fill you in on them. You can find DNA on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
The changing face of charity. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. In the aftermath of last summer's sudden fad for victims of Lou Gehrig's disease, American charities were struck with ice bucket fever. People raised $115 million by dumping ice on their heads, but that exercise in viral giving was not sustainable for humanitarian fundraising. Charities that go viral are not always cost-effective. Why do people donate to one thing and not another? Can social media help lift the level of giving above the tiny percentage of GDP where it's languished for years? Today's talking point is Blue America turning against football. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. America's charitable giving has reached only 2% of the GDP for many years now. Do social media and mobile devices offer new ways to raise it? How important is it for donors to know that the money they give is being used effectively? Today's talking point, cracks are beginning to appear between red and blue when it comes to America's secular religion, football. First, this story. Made in the USA sells these days, but made in Detroit may sell even better. That's the lesson of Shinola, based in a city famous for decay and depopulation, but selling luxury products to upscale consumers in places like Palm Beach and Beverly Hills. Karen Heller covers business and style for The Washington Post. Hi, Karen.
Nice to be here.
Tell us about Shinola. Why did they locate in Detroit?
Oh, this was intentional. The owner of the company is based in Plano, Texas, but they clearly knew that there was a desire among American consumers to buy domestic, but Detroit rang even stronger. The idea of job creation, the idea of helping the city that's in bankruptcy. And they intentionally moved to the city. Most of the executives are from elsewhere and started to hire locals.
You suggest this may have something to do with consumer guilt.
Yes, I think there is quite a bit of consumer guilt that there's certainly been a rash of stories about how many of our goods, like Apple products, are made overseas as much as we love them. We have a lot of American companies. We just don't produce much here. I think that's one of the reasons why people just love the farm-to-table movement and food. And I think there's a lot about Shinola that sort of mirrors that, knowing where your goods are produced, seeing the people who make them, the idea that you know the origins of the things that you own. And I think what Shinola is doing is the consumers will pay more for this.
Shinola, the name of a shoe polish during World War II, does it make shoe polish?
Yes. Well, what happened is that Shinola was a defunct brand that was actually out of Rochester, New York, and they were joking around in a marketing meeting about what to call it, and somebody used the old World War II expression, you don't know blank from Shinola. And Tom Katsasis, who owns the company, who founded Fossil, he sort of loved the idea and they ran with this. He has a very unusual sense of humor. His holding company is called Bedrock after the Flintstones' hometown. And in fact, when they have breaks at the factory in the Argonaut, the old Argonaut research building General Motors had and is now a arts college in Detroit, they have the Yabba Dabba Doo goes out to the workers that it's time for break. So in doing this, they bought the rights to the name because the company was defunct, and they just decided, oh, what the heck, we'll revive the Shinola shoe polish. And that's another thing that really interested me about the company. These are a lot of products that don't naturally, logically go together. Their number one product is watches. Most of them sell at $550 or more. They make bikes, and bikes and watches actually have nothing to do with each other other than that they have gears, and they don't have the same kind of gears. And then they, or fine movements. And they also make leather goods. And traditionally, leather goods have nothing to do with watches. Watch companies generally outsource making leather watch bands. And so they now have revived the shoe polish, and they make that in Chicago, and it's they don't make shoes. So there you go.
On all of their products, as I understand it, Detroit appears, the word Detroit. Is anything actually made in Detroit?
Yes, the watches are definitely made in Detroit. I visited the factory, and the watch straps are now being made increasingly in Detroit. The leather goods will be made more, and almost all of the products are being made at really venerable American companies. The watch straps are coming out of a company in Florida. The leather goods are coming from a very fine old leather company. That's the only thing about the company that's really not made in the United States is some of the fine movements in the watches are coming from Switzerland. And the other investor, along with Kartzatsis, is Rondo, which is a Swiss watch giant. But they really are making a conscious effort. And in fact, are trying to revive leather goods. They now make journals. Now, that's outsourced to another company, but the company is American.
They're selling stuff, as I understand it, again, in Beverly Hills and Palm Beach and in lots of upscale stores. Are they making money?
Well, they're privately held, so it's hard to know. But what they say is that last year they made $20 billion in sales, and this year, $60. The CEO told me that they were on track to actually make more than about three and a half times what they did last year. But they weren't fully the production only started, was only like in production for about 7 months last year. But the watches are definitely driving the company right now. Bill Clinton famously visited the plant in April. He has bought 14. He hawks the company every chance he can get. I mean, everybody roots for Detroit, and that's part of the brilliance of their marketing. It's not just simply that Detroit is stamped on everything, but they understand that this is now an underdog story, and we love those stories.
Has anybody else come to Detroit in order to see Shinola?
Oh, yes. Well, they constantly, when I was there, their tour buses, they have two very nice stores, and tour buses show up. They have the Shinola store, which is beautiful and has an espresso bar. They assemble the bikes in the back, and they've just opened what they claim to be the only watch-style face company in the United States. And then they have another store down, like two doors down, called Willie's. Kartzatsis also owns the brand Pilsen that's out of, I believe, Washington State.
Once again, Karen Heller is with the Washington Post. In a moment, the changing face of charity on To the Point.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To The Point. This past August, the Ice Bucket Challenge brought in more than $115 million to fight against Lou Gehrig's disease. The money went to the ALS Foundation, a charity that took in less than $3 million in August of last year. Indirectly, that focused attention on charitable giving itself. Why we do it? And why we don't, and on how humanitarian charities can raise more money than they do now. Dan Pallotta invented AIDS rides and three-day fundraisers for breast cancer. He is president and founder of the Charity Defense Council. Dan Pallotta, thanks for joining our program.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's Christmas. For those who don't remember the Ice Bucket Challenge in August, let's just go over it briefly. Tell us.
Well, the Ice Bucket Challenge was a viral peer-to-peer fundraising initiative where people challenged their friends to pour a bucket of ice over their heads and donate money to ALS, and it just took off like wildfire, and as you said, raised about $115 million, just towering over anything they had raised before.
Has the ALS Foundation been able to use that in some way to sustain its increased fundraising?
I don't know. I'm not affiliated with ALS, but I know that, you know, immediately people wanted to make sure, as we traditionally have, that 100% of that money is going to the cause. So ALS would have a very difficult time with our traditional cultural mindset, taking a healthy chunk of that money and investing it in fundraising endeavors for the future so that they can continue to raise that much money. And, you know, we as a society just don't know that we're shooting ourselves in the foot when we insist that these charities spend 100% of the money on the cause, because once that money is gone, they're right back to where they started.
Doesn't make a lot of sense, but very often you see reports about some charity, whether it's the Red Cross or somebody else, who is spending more, it would appear, than is the right amount on administration and fundraising. Is there some right amount, some percentage that is appropriate?
Well, it seems to me that the right amount is to spend as much money as you can on fundraising until it no longer raises more money. Otherwise, you're leaving money on the table. You know, if you could raise, we use the bake sale at, you know, that has 5% overhead. We hold that up on a pedestal and say, you know, that's the most efficient way of raising money. And then we discourage the professional fundraising enterprise with 40% overhead. But we never look at what the volume is. The bake sale may have netted $71 for the cause with a 5% overhead. The professional fundraising enterprise may have netted $71 million. Now, which figure do we think is more likely to have an impact on the cause? We just have been taught all the wrong things. The American public has just been duped into asking this question about what percentage goes to overhead. You don't go into, you know, Nike Town and say, bring me the shoes with the lowest overhead. I don't care how good the shoes are or how long they're going to last. I just want the shoes with the lowest overhead. But that's how we've been taught to think about charity, and it's as irrational and backwards as it possibly could be.
What about viral fundraising? Is that a satisfactory way to go or effective?
Well, here's the problem. I love everything about the Ice Bucket Challenge, except for the standard that people now want to hold charities up to. You know, the Ice Bucket Challenge cost ALS virtually nothing. It was a fluke. It took off for them, and now you're going to see, you know, lots of people holding charities to the same standard. Well, why can't you have a zero-cost fundraising endeavor that goes viral like ALS did? And that's just unrealistic. You know, we need to invest money in new fundraising ideas. You know, imagine if Apple had no R&D budget for the iPhone and just had to count on a fluke, you know, of innovation to develop its next product. So the truth of the matter is, while technology has changed dramatically over the last 20 years, our thinking has not. So we get all excited about viral giving and online giving, but the truth is charitable giving has remained stuck constant at 2% of GDP ever since we started measuring it in the 1970s. So instead of people mailing in a check now, they do it online. You know, one has cannibalized the other. And until we start to give charities more freedom to invest in reaching the consumer the way Coca-Cola does, we're not going to see that 2% figure change. These charities aren't going to grow, and these problems are going to remain with us for time immemorial.
Dan Pallotta, once again, president and founder of the Charity Defense Council. Stacy Palmer is editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Thank you so much for being on our program.
Happy to join you.
What have you learned, or what do you think has been learned from the Ice Bucket Challenge? Did it, for example, show that despite what we hear from Dan Pallotta about the limitations of the Internet works?
It's absolutely amazing. People had thought for a long time that you could get attention online, but you really couldn't do anything with social media. Other than that, you'd never raise any money. And then all of a sudden, Facebook especially, it turned out to be tremendous as a fundraising tool. So I think that's one of the lessons a lot of fundraisers are taking away, is trying to think not about how they can do another Ice Bucket Challenge, but is it really indeed possible to think that social media will help us raise a lot of money?
Has it, though, set up a artificial artificial standard, as Dan Pallotta suggests. In fact, a false standard that, in fact, it is possible to raise money without spending money.
I think that absolutely is a concern. But one of the things that the Ice Bucket Challenge showed is that when you get your volunteers and lots of people excited and interested in your cause, they will spread that in a great way to other people. And that's one of the things that nonprofits can really learn from, is that it doesn't always take the professional fundraisers coming up with an idea. As a matter of fact, sometimes the best ideas come from your volunteers. There are absolutely downsides to this approach, but it's wonderful to see people reaching out and bringing in people who had never heard of ALS before, and now they were giving to a cause that they would never have thought about donating to.
Are there other examples where people have come up with ideas and been able to raise significant amounts of money without using professional fundraisers and having a lot of overhead?
One of the things we certainly see with a lot of the crowdfunding sites is that kind of approach where people will start something on Kickstarter, for example, or use any of those kinds of things. And it's that one-on-one approach that tends to work. But at a certain point, to raise really serious money, we do need good professional fundraisers who spend the time figuring out how to connect people with a cause. And I think one of the other concerns people have about some of these online approaches is, how do you know what's fraudulent? How do you really know that a charity is legitimate? If anybody can just sort of set up a site and say they're putting the money out on social media, what distinguishes a legitimate charity from an illegitimate one?
How do you find out?
You have to ask some tough questions and make sure that you're giving to a legitimate cause. Ask for their informational tax returns and get some backup kinds of information. But be very careful. And anytime something looks suspicious or high pressure, that's always a sign that something is not right.
Let me go back to Dan Pallotta with the Charity Defense Council. You say we need some new ideas in this age of new technology, that our thinking hasn't improved at all. What do you propose?
Well, I think that charities have to invest a great deal more in fundraising. You know, they have to invest a great deal more in letting the public know about the good that they do so that they can raise more revenue. If you look at the Health and Human Services in 2006, which is the last year we have a figure for, spent about $1.5 billion on marketing, versus $729 billion for the rest of the economy. So hundreds and hundreds of messages for things other than a health and human services cause for every message you see for a health and human services cause. Or you compare something like, you know, Susan Komen spent $25 million on advertising in 2012 to make people more aware of the breast cancer cause. L'Oreal spent $1.5 billion trying to build consumer demand for the sale of more cosmetics and beauty products. And until we start to think at that scale, these charities are all going to remain miniature up against the scale of the problem. So if we want to do a little bit of good, the system as we have it right now works fine. If we want to see some of these problems solved in our lifetime, then we have to think radically differently about our approach to it.
How much of the charitable giving, Dan Pallotta, goes to religious organizations, and do they use overhead and fundraising techniques in order to get their money?
Yeah, I don't know the exact breakdown. I know that the Health and Human Services portion of the sector is about 18% of the total, and the rest is higher education, religious institutions, and hospitals. And, you know, a hospital is a different situation because there's so much fee for service there. And, you know, they're taking in huge amounts of money in fee revenue, and people don't ask about the overhead on those kinds of things. Even colleges, you know, it's remarkable. People get all bent out of shape when they hear that the head of the Boys and Girls Clubs or the American Cancer Society is making $700,000 or $800,000. I mean, and Anderson Cooper wants to investigate. Nobody wants to investigate the fact that the top 20 college football coaches at nonprofit government-supported universities last year each made $2.6 million. You know, do we really feel that college football in a nonprofit setting is that much more important than finding a cure for cancer?
We'll be talking about college football a little later on our program. First, let me introduce Henry Timms. He's the founder of Giving Tuesday. That is now an annual event using social media to encourage charitable giving. He's also executive director of the 92nd Street Y in New York. Henry Timms, good to have you with us.
It's great to be on the show.
Tell us about Giving Tuesday. When did it start, and how does it work?
So 2 years ago, we here at the 92nd Street Y were thinking, you know, we know about Black Friday. We know about Cyber Monday, which are 2 days all about getting deals. What about Giving Tuesday? So what about a day which is really about giving back? And that was the simple idea which began Giving Tuesday. And it really caught on in some ways that were beyond our initial expectations. And this year, Giving Tuesday had 20,000 partners in all 50 states. And we saw online giving increase by around 63% across the country this year. But I think we also saw something else which kind of comes up in some of Dan's comments, which is really a sector thinking about how do we tell stories, about how do we engage at scale, and about how can we get messages across to really permeate into the American public about a lot of good causes. And Giving Tuesday, we did that in some interesting ways, and we're learning a lot, I think, especially about how viral and social media are changing philanthropy.
Tell us how you used it.
So Giving Tuesday was really designed in a fairly open source way. So just as the retail world comes together around Black Friday or Cyber Monday, the philanthropic world came together around Giving Tuesday. So by using the hashtag Giving Tuesday, it meant that people everywhere could engage around the same central message. But then what happened was they very much made that message their own. So one great example was the University of Michigan turned Giving Tuesday into Giving Blue Day, which was their first ever 24-hour online giving effort. Their goal was $1 million. They raised $3.5 million, mostly from the kind of $5 to $150 range. But I think what was really interesting about that, which tells us a story about social media and philanthropy, was how they engaged their organization. Everyone from the president through to their alumni through to famous alums were actually out there on the day tweeting, sharing messages via social media. And what they did was actually mobilize. They really took a kind of movement mindset to how they approached giving. And that, I think, is a big lesson for all of us in the nonprofit community, which is how do we get more and more people working for our organizations to take some of these ideas to scale?
How do you approach the concern that Dan Pallotta raised, though, in fact, this creates the impression that you can raise money without spending money?
So actually, I don't think that is the case in the same way with Giving Tuesday. I think a lot of people actually put together very thoughtful campaigns around how they think about year-end, and no one was expecting the kind of magic which I think we saw with the Ice Bucket Challenge. In fact, I'll go further and say I think what was interesting about Giving Tuesday was how thoughtful organizations were about how they can make this strategic. And I'll just give you two examples. The Nightingale Bamford School here in New York, their Giving Tuesday commitment wasn't anything to do with money. What they said was we can put together a free curriculum from K-12 which helps parents and teachers everywhere teach the next generation of philanthropists to get involved. No money will change hands this year for Giving Tuesday around that curriculum, but in a decade's time, in 2 decades' time, that kind of effort really pays off. And then we saw things like H&M, a big corporate brand, who on Giving Tuesday donated $7.5 million of clothes to families in need. So this year, Giving Tuesday really kind of was the first year it began to kind of penetrate the national consciousness a bit more. And I think what we're excited about is the possibility of the philanthropic world being very loud and very proud about the way we can really come into the world and start solving some big problems.
And very specifically, I gather, you're targeting younger people.
So what was interesting, some data we saw around Giving Tuesday this year, which was fascinating, was that 17% of donations were from mobile devices. So you're seeing a lot more people actually giving via their cell phones. And as we think about statistics more generally, you know, half of the world is 30 or under. There are more cell phones than people. The way in which digital technology is going to transform philanthropy, just as it's changed everything else, is going to be so significant over the next 5 to 10 years. And I think one thing we're all challenged to do in the sector is think about these new tools and, more importantly, think about these new behaviors. Because in my mind, what's interesting about the Ice Bucket Challenge and what's interesting to some degree, too, about Giving Tuesday is what you're seeing is a thirst for participation. Right, the days of send out the letter and get the check back are actually very limited from a participation standpoint. But what people, particularly a younger generation, are demanding of us is how can they be more engaged? And one thing that I think we see from a Giving Tuesday perspective is those organizations who are thinking of their constituents not just as donors, but as owners, as people who really can own their cause.
Okay, hold that thought, because we need to take a break. We'll come back and continue this conversation a little later on our talking point, America's latest partisan divide, football. Back in a moment with To The Point from PRI.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
Warman Olney back with To The Point, once again talking about charitable giving in the age of social media, with the prime example at the moment being the Ice Bucket Challenge, which raised orders of magnitude more for Lou Gehrig's disease and the ALS Foundation. By chance, as it were, simply by accident, as people began sending pictures of themselves around dumping ice on their heads as they were giving money to ALS. I want to go back to Henry Timms with the 92nd Street Y, the founder of the hashtag Giving Tuesday. What about the concern for slacktivism, the idea that people aren't really giving money to the charity, they're rather giving money because they look good to their friends on Facebook?
Well, I think the idea of people giving money to look good isn't a new one. That's not something social media invented. A lot of the great philanthropists proudly lent their names to things that they did, so I don't think we should discourage that. And in fact, I think there's a lot to be said for people very proudly sharing their ideas around philanthropy. You know, if you look at the data on philanthropy, the most powerful way to ask for money in the world is if your friend asks of you to give. And one thing social media allows people to do is actually make that ask in interesting networked ways. So as we go forward, I think one of the things we'll see a lot more of is people actually very proudly not just talking about what they've given, but asking other people to give too. And the network effects of that, I think, can be significant, as we saw in the case of the Ice Bucket Challenge, and I think increasingly as we see in the case of Giving Tuesday.
Back to Stacey Palmer, the editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Is that something that resonates with you, the idea that if you have a friend ask another friend to donate, that's the most powerful motivator of all?
Absolutely. That's how people learn about good causes and learn what to trust in some ways. But, you know, the challenge with that is, of course, it's limiting. It means that some causes that are very worthy don't get the attention that they should just because you might not have a friend who knows about that. So I think what we really need to be able to find ways to break through and do better storytelling, as both Dan and Henry have talked about, and try to get attention to the causes that just aren't the type of, you know, disease charities, for example, do very well with people who have the disease and talk to friends and relatives. But what about the tougher causes like domestic abuse that people don't want to talk about? How do we raise money for those kinds of causes?
Neil Bowerman has joined us. He is co-founder of the Center for Effective Altruism, who takes a different perspective on this issue. That's an incubator that is focused on developing cost-effective charities. Neil Bowerman, thank you very much for being on our program.
Thanks for having me.
What do you mean by cost-effective?
So there are a number of different ways that people, number of different reasons that people give. People can give because they have an emotional connection, because a friend asked them to look good, to feel good, or they can give actually to do good, to make an impact in the world. And so cost effectiveness asks the question of, well, how can I have more impact with my donation? And so this has become a bit of a science. There's a number of ways that we can measure how much good you can do in different areas. For example, if you're tackling climate change, measuring tons of CO2, or in global health, there's a measure of quality and length of life that you can use to compare different health-based interventions. And so cost effectiveness and effective altruism more generally looks at how can I have the most impact I can with my donation.
Do you think people are that analytical about it, or do they give more on impulse, or because they feel sympathy, or because they like something that they want to contribute to, or because they're concerned about somebody's welfare?
Yeah, so people give for a number of different reasons. But what I have found interesting is that when you start to present people with the data, they start to realize just quite how much good they can do if they start to pay attention to the numbers. So, for example, in the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge, the most cost-effective medicine for that was costing around $55,000 for each additional year of life that it was providing ALS sufferers. In comparison, you can give someone the same improvement in quality of life if they're suffering from neglected tropical diseases. These are worms that get into your gut and into your eyes for just around $55. That's $55 compared to $55,000. So that means that by choosing the right charities, you can have over 1,000 times more impact with your money. And so that's why around the time of the Ice Bucket Challenge, I was encouraging people not just to think about giving more, but also thinking about giving more effectively to places like Deworm the World, who work in this neglected tropical disease area. And actually, the world leaders on this are GiveWell. They're at givewell.com. And you can check out, they have what I think is some of the best analysis in the world on where your money can go furthest in terms of really making an impact on people's lives.
You're not suggesting that you would be hard-hearted about this, and by giving effectively, you would necessarily be not giving to something else.
Well, so we always have to make a choice. By giving money to ALS, you are implicitly not giving that money to another charity. Every single charitable donation we make is giving it somewhere rather than somewhere else. So we are resource constrained. Ideally, I'd give infinite amounts of money to all charities. But unfortunately, I don't have infinite amount of money. I only have a certain amount of money. So I have to choose where it goes. And what I'm arguing for is, why don't we use the data that's available to choose the places where it can go the furthest?
Does this suggest, Neil Bowerman, that one of the reasons we have charities is that we're not doing enough collectively with the government agencies, for example, in order to deal with some of the major problems that we have to cope with?
Yeah, so there's always going to be a larger role the government can play, and there's always going to be additional opportunities where charities can have an impact. Where I think it gets interesting and exciting is where government, instead of simply rolling out their programs without testing them, where they implement them in some places and not in others, and then they compare the results in these two areas and see how much the program makes a difference. And what's interesting is when Brookings, for example, studied 10 different social programs that have been rolled out by government, they found that, in fact, 9 of them weren't making a major difference to people's lives. And the same thing actually goes for charities. Unfortunately, some charitable programs are not having a significant impact on people's lives when you start to measure it compared to a group that didn't receive the treatment. And so once we can start to look at these results and ask, how much is this improving people's lives? Then we can start to see how much impact is actually happening. But unfortunately, most people don't ask these hard questions about how much good is this actually doing? How much change in the world is my money actually going to buy? And instead, they simply listen to the stories that people give about, oh, once upon a time, we helped this person and it changed their life. That's all good and well, but what about on average? You're not going to be helping that person that had a good story about them. You're going to be helping the next person. And for that is a much harder question, and a question that we need to start approaching more analytically.
Neil Bowerman, again, co-founder of the Center for Effective Altruism. Let me go back to Stacey Palmer at the Chronicle of Philanthropy. How often does it happen that some person with considerable resources wants to devote charitable giving to a cause that's not effective in the way that Neil Bowerman suggests? Does anybody have a responsibility to try to redirect that money?
That's one of the things that a lot of people in the charity world are talking about now, is to try to say, how can we make sure that donors are smart givers? And in some ways, the wonderful thing about philanthropy is that it's voluntary, but sometimes it doesn't do much good. Obviously, more of the problems in the world would be solved if we had smarter philanthropy. So how can we teach people to learn from the mistakes of others and not keep repeating the same things over and over again? That's one reason it's smart for the press to give good coverage to philanthropy and ask questions when they think somebody's throwing away money and giving it to a bad cause. So, you know, one of the concerns some people have is that everybody thinks all philanthropy is good. Well, some of it isn't as smart as it should be. It's all good-hearted, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it does good. So that the more we can know, one of the things a lot of charities are doing now is measuring their results, in part because foundations are asking them to do that. And just as an average donor, we can all ask that question, how do you know what you're doing is working? And if a charity doesn't have a good answer to it, it means they're not even looking at that. So you might want to move along and say, you know, invest your money with a group that is understanding, learning from its mistakes, talking about where it failed. Because sometimes when it's taking risky projects on, it will fail. That's a good thing.
Dan Pallotta, back to you. You were concerned at the outset about questioning the use of investment in order to raise money, spending money to raise money. What about looking at charities and asking these questions about effectiveness? Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely critical. I mean, the point that Neil makes is essential. The point that Stacy makes is essential. We run the risk of being a generation whose epitaph is going to read, "We kept charity overhead low," because that's all we ever asked about. And we never asked whether the charity was doing any good or whether the charity was doing good and growing. You know, I think what's true is everybody on this call and everybody listening, we all want to make a difference in our lives, and we want to make a big difference. You know, we would like to see, before our lives are over, some of these problems solved, and we're just not thinking big enough. We have to start to think on a much bigger scale. You know, everything that Henry says about Giving Tuesday is true. It's just a wonderful, wonderful vehicle and innovative. Now imagine if Giving Tuesday, instead of having maybe $1 million to promote itself, had $100 million to promote itself. Imagine if it had the kind of budget that Budweiser has to make people aware of Giving Tuesday. You can just look at NPR if you want to talk about the value of making the public aware. Imagine if NPR couldn't do its pledge drives. That's advertising, right? I don't know whether NPR even accounts for it as a fundraising cost or not. There's the proof right there. Or when a disaster happens and it's all over the news, donations start pouring in. We have to move. We have to think much bigger. Instead of thinking about small tactics, we have to start to think, how do we move charitable giving in the United States from 2% of GDP to 3% of GDP? How do we direct that money to the best, most effective organizations that actually have a shot at solving some of these problems? And overhead be damned, let's look at solving these problems, because that's what we all want.
Dan Pallotta, once again, at the Charity Defense Council. Back to Henry Timms at the 92nd Street Y, the creator of the hashtag Giving Tuesday. What do you think are the prospects for raising the total amount from 2% to 3% of gross national product when you're focusing on young people and when you're focusing on people that use mobile phones, for example, who seem to me to be somewhat less eager to interact with big institutions than they are to do things on their own?
So I think that's what's coming next. I think the other way of thinking about the 2% is it could be 1.8%. It could be 1.6%. So the fact that 2% of GDP is going in a positive direction is not something we should ever take for granted. But I agree, too, with Dan, that we need to be rallying to get that number up and to get more money going to great causes. I think, too, that one of the dangers that we have is the conversation we have about people trying to do good things in the world tends to too often default to this kind of skepticism and cynicism about overhead or are they really doing any good. And the one thing I think I see most frequently, and I think it's true of a new generation, is huge optimism. The people who are imagining the future of philanthropy are not spending their time wondering about why things shouldn't work. They're spending their time thinking very big about what might come next and how we're going to get there and what new systems might work. So as we think about a new generation coming to the table, I wouldn't be skeptical and I wouldn't be cynical. I would be incredibly optimistic, but they need to have a lot of time to think and to plan and to really structurally think about how we can make some of these problems go away.
Neil Bowerman, back to you with the Center for Effective Altruism. What do you do about a word that was used earlier by Stacy Palmer, and that is fraud? A lot of people are trying to commit a fraud and do so in the name of charity.
So the approach that an organization like GiveWell, for example, who vet these charities do, is they really look at the very best charities, and they vet them very heavily. They look through all of their past filed expenses and tax returns, and they interview members of the board and the people that they've helped as well. And from this, you can really start to get quite a good picture. And unfortunately, this does take some time. Which is why I personally don't choose my charitable giving myself anymore. I rely on other independent experts such as Gibwell to do that for me, because it does take time. But once you get an organization like Gibwell that can give it a stamp of approval, then you really know that that you can put your money and your time behind this. So, for example, I have friends who've seen this this data and this information, and they have decided to give 70% of their income, not 2%, not 3%, like we've been talking about, but 70% of their income away to these very top charities that have been carefully vetted and shown to be effective. So one of the things that I've done over the past 5 years is help to set up an organization called Giving What We Can, which is encourages people to give 10% or more of their income to the most cost-effective charities at fighting global poverty. And the reason that people sign up and do this is because they really can be sure that if they follow these recommendations, that they can have a lot of impact. We started out just as a few people and have grown to a few hundred, and yet collectively we've pledged over $333 billion in donations over the rest of our lifetimes to cost-effective causes, and generated millions of dollars of donations. And this is literally just a few hundred people around the world deciding they're going to make this a big part of their life, and they are going to take these steps to improve the lives of others.
These are people. Sounds like these are people of some means.
No, definitely not always. I have friends who are teachers, who are security guards, who are social workers, academics, nurses from all walks of life. Who are able to give 10% of their income.
But they don't give 70%. They don't all give 70%, though.
No. To give 70%, sometimes they're earning a bit more, but I do have a friend who's a social worker who gives half of her income away to charity. It's definitely doable. It just takes a fair bit of thinking and planning and budgeting quite carefully. But if you look at this and you realize, actually, hey, over my lifetime, I can actually save several people's lives. It starts to seem more worth doing. We think of if you were walking down past a burning house and you managed to pull a child out and save their life, that would be something that sticks with you really for the rest of your lifetime. And yet we can have that much impact every single year if we donate 10% or more of our income away. So why wouldn't we do that?
And Stacey Palmer, back to you with the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Is there evidence that when people learn that a charity is effective in the way that you have all said they ought to be, that people are more willing then to contribute money to it?
Sadly, that doesn't seem to be the case. There's been a fair amount of research that's been done, and it's not all that conclusive that people necessarily give more when they know more. We need to educate people so that they understand that, but the basic instincts aren't always there. So I think that's why a lot of people in the charity world are trying to talk about this focus on results. And as Dan is correct, people look at that overhead question instead of thinking about, you know, if they focused on effectiveness, what would happen? And I think one of the other things they need to think about is what is the right percentage of income to give, as we've talked about during this conversation. We just did a study that looked at people of different income levels and found that those who are very rich are giving a smaller share of their income compared to those who are poor and more moderate income. So one great way we could raise the amount of money that goes to charity is if people who had a little bit more means thought more about whether they could rise up.
Well, thank you all very much for talking to us today about charitable giving and how it has changed and how it has not changed with regard to technology as it has developed in recent years. Stacey Palmer is editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Thanks very much to you. Neil Bowerman is co-founder of the Center for Effective Altruism, which is developing cost-effective charities. He told us what cost-effective means. Our other guests agreed with his definition. Henry Timms, founder of the hashtag Giving Tuesday, an annual event that uses social media to encourage charitable giving. He's also executive director of the 92nd Street Y. And Dan Pallotta, president and founder of the Charity Defense Council, also a creator of the AIDS Rides and Breast Cancer 3-Day Fundraising Events. Thank you all very much for being on our program once again today. The divide between Republicans and Democrats is not just a matter of the voting booth. Every slice of America, of course, does in fact watch football. But you might be surprised to know that in many ways, football has become one of the issues that has caused a partisan divide in this country. We'll be back in a moment with that on To the Point from PRI.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream, featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
Warren Alnebeck with today's talking point. Football is still a secular religion in much of the country, but skeptics and dissenters are beginning to appear with the dividing line parallel to what separates political partisans. That's according to David Leonard, who's former Washington bureau chief for the New York Times, now editor of the paper's news and data project, The Upshot. Hi, David. Good to have you with us.
It's good to be back.
Tell us how political partisanship appears to be expressing itself in the way people feel about football.
Well, I'll start with the way it's not expressing itself, which is both liberal and conservative America continue to watch enormous amounts of football. There's no sign of that changing. But there are signs of change in who lets their sons play football. There are two pieces of evidence that we see a change that is sharper in blue America than red America. The first is data on who's playing high school sports. And the states with the bigger declines in people playing football tend to be bluer states. Maryland, Colorado, which is more like a purple state but voted for Obama twice, Minnesota, Wisconsin, New York, California. We see really noticeable declines, 15% decline in the last 6 years in the number of boys playing high school football in both Minnesota and Wisconsin, for example. And the other, which supports that, is a poll that we just did working with the RAND Corporation, in which we asked people, would you be comfortable having your son play football? And it was interesting. Football was lower percentage across the board, but it was noticeably lower among a group of people who, A, said they voted for President Obama in 2012, and B, have college degrees. And so there seems to be particular concern among people who tend to lean left politically and who are more educated about the dangers of football.
Does this suggest that there is a political elite that is somehow turning its back on a sport that's popular with everybody else?
Well, I mean, we use the word elite. We tend to use the word elite with negative connotations. I think to some extent it does suggest that there is an elite that's turning its back on having its kids play that sport. Mm. But elite also can mean something else, which is if there was once a time in which the people warning about the dangers of smoking were the so-called elites, and the people saying everyone should wear a seatbelt were the so-called elites. And I don't think football is destined to go down that path. I think there is a way in which football remains as popular as it is. Maybe we find out the dangers aren't so big in high school. Maybe they change the rules. Maybe they come up with some better equipment to protect players. But I don't think it's out of the question by any means that football does follow a path that looks like seatbelts or smoking or boxing, to use maybe the most worrisome analogy for football, in which what was once something that was so big in American society that you couldn't imagine otherwise starts to change over time. And those changes often start among the elites.
And that happened with boxing?
It did. I mean, think about how incredibly popular boxing was. As I talk about in my column, my family was a family full of boxing fans. My grandfather took a bus in 1938 from Philadelphia to New York to watch Joe Louis knock out Max Schmeling at Yankee Stadium. I have memories of the 1980s. My dad would pop popcorn and let me stay up late, and we'd watch Marvelous Marvin Hagler and Tommy Hearns, and we'd watch these fights. And we don't watch boxing anymore. We, like many people, we were just turned off as the evidence mounted, as you saw Muhammad Ali. You know, it's worth remembering, 80 years ago, boxing was one of the major sports in this country, along with baseball and horse racing.
Sugar Ray Robinson was big stuff in the, 60s, wasn't he, and 70s?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, again, really, I mean, really into the 80s, you go back and you look at the cover of Sports Illustrated magazine, you look at promotion. I mean, boxing really remained a mainstream sport. Obviously, boxing in the 80s was nothing like football today. But boxing's decline did not happen rapidly. It happened over many decades. And although I really don't know what's going to happen here, I can imagine two very different scenarios. But I do think it's plausible to consider the idea that football slowly starts to lose ground in this country.
What does this have to do with people beginning to read more and more articles about concussions and other kinds of injuries and the alumni of the NFL suing the league for continued injuries suffered while they were playing?
I think it's all about that. I really don't think it has anything to do with the latest stuff we've heard about NFL players breaking the law or domestic violence. I mean, those are obviously incredibly serious issues, and some of those stories have just made you so angry to hear how the league handled them and what the players did. But I don't really think this is about that. I think it's all about the concussions. My colleague Alan Schwartz at the Times was really the journalist in those early years who was breaking the most news on this, and it's clear that NFL players put their bodies and their brains at some substantial risk. I think there is a real question, and I don't think we know that much about it yet. What are those risks look like for high school players and youth players who obviously play football for many fewer hours and don't hit as hard? And it's worth remembering that there are other sports that have risks too. Soccer brings risks because of the heading of the ball. And I think what we don't yet know is among high school kids, are the risks of football different really qualitatively from any other sport? And I think what we're seeing is a lot of more educated, more liberal families are saying, we're not going to wait till the evidence comes in on this. We're not exposing our son to those potential risks.
Interesting when you point out that it's people with college degrees and people who voted for Obama who tend to feel uncomfortable about their children playing football. The president himself exemplifies the dichotomy because he's a football fan who has been known to be a smoker who also has indicated that he wouldn't let his son play football.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In an interview with The New Yorker's David Remnick, President Obama said, I would not let my son play football. He said, I would not let my son play pro football if I had a son. He then also said, I continue to watch a lot. And he defended it in two ways. One, he said, my attitude is they know what they're doing. It's sort of like smoking, which, as you note, he is a smoker. That's not a particularly reassuring analogy if you're running a football business, right? Football does not want to follow the path of smoking. And then, although I didn't mention this in the column, he needled David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, who was doing the interview, and he said, hey, look, you write a lot about boxing, too, basically saying a lot of people may be fascinated by sports and forms of entertainment that bring some public health risks.
David Leonard, always good to talk with you. Thanks for joining us.
It's always good to be on. Thanks for having me.
Editor of The Upshot, News and Data Project of The New York Times. To the Point is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.